The case will be taken under advisement. We move to the final case this morning, United States versus Purim. Ms. Kramer.
May it please the court, my name is Britt Kramer, and I represent the appellant, Sylvester Purim. In my briefing, I raised several arguments as to why Mr. Purim's sentence should be reversed and remanded. Today, I'd like to focus on two issues in particular. First, the district court's failure to make any express relevant conduct findings as required by this court's precedent. And second, on the fact that the contents of Mr. Purim's pre-sentencing report alone do not adequately demonstrate that the charged offense is intertwined with the 2008 transactions. First,
could I just ask you something that's been bothering me? Because the government stated that Purim's brother, Howard, was held accountable for 840 grams. Even though he was not held responsible for the 2008 relevant conduct. Is there a reason why Purim would not be responsible for the same amount as his brother for the offense of conviction without considering the 2008 conduct?
Well, Your Honor, I actually haven't had any access to Howard Purim's pre-sentencing report, so unfortunately I don't have enough information to fully answer your question. But my understanding is that the government apparently didn't find Howard Purim's conduct foreseeable to Sylvester. That's the only reason that I can think of for why he also wouldn't have been held accountable for the 840 grams.
Thanks.
I'd like to return to my point that the district court was required to make express relevant conduct findings in this case. It failed to do so here, and remand is appropriate on this ground alone. This court has repeatedly cautioned that district courts must be scrupulous and carefully scrutinize whether the government has adhered to the limits of the relevant conduct rule. This is because this rule is, quote, a fearsome tool that so favors the government, particularly the prosecution in drug aggregation cases. In order to demonstrate or police the prosecution and to make sure that the government has adhered to these limits, a district court must, quote, explicitly state and support, preferably in its written statement of reasons, its relevant conduct findings. And without such statement, an appellate court cannot evaluate whether this decision was proper. Here, the district court findings are facially inadequate. The district court only found that, first, the PSR was reliable, and second, that Purim began transporting crack cocaine in 2008. I would argue that the case of United States v. Sumner controls here. In that case, this court found that remand was appropriate where the court had adopted the PSR in its entirety as reliable, but had made no findings as to significant similarity, regularity, or temporal proximity between the charged offense and the uncharged conduct. In Sumner, there was in fact more evidence tending to demonstrate a relevant conduct finding than there is in this case. Mr. Sumner was charged with powder cocaine sales in 1999, and there was evidence that he had sold crack cocaine from winter 1997 until he switched to powder in January 1998. The PSR also established that Mr. Sumner had purchased the drugs from the same supplier initially. Nevertheless, this court remanded Mr. Sumner's sentence on the ground that the district court had inadequately demonstrated that the uncharged crack cocaine was related to the powder cocaine offense. The government here additionally does not contest the fact that the district court made no independent findings. Instead, it merely suggests that that the district court adopted the PSR in its entirety. However, where a district court has entirely relied on a PSR, this court has emphasized that the PSR itself must explain or establish the relevant nexus between the uncharged conduct and the offense of conviction. It is also stated repeatedly that participation in other drug transactions is not enough. Here, there's been no explanation in Mr. Perham's PSR as to why the 2008 transaction should count against the 2010-2011 conspiracy. Instead, the only evidence demonstrates that the 2010 conspiracy arose 2 years later, after the 2008 transactions, involved none of the same accomplices, none of the same customers, and dramatically different drug weights. The district court did not engage in a finding of showing significant similarity, regularity, and temporal proximity. The government now attests that this court should find that the district court held that these things were similar based on gang affiliation. But this is little more than a post hoc rationalization that is not supported by the record. Mr. Perham's PSR never identifies anyone other than Mr. Perham himself and his brother, Howard, as gang affiliated. It also provides no information whatsoever as to when this purported gang affiliation arose. Consequently, there's no evidence that anyone in the 2008 drug transactions were related to the Black Peastone Nation, other than the government's assertion today.
And the Perhams, right?
And the Perhams, but only Sylvester Perham was involved in the 2008 transactions. I would attest that where there's this paucity of facts and terse findings of reliability, this is an insufficient showing of related and intertwined conduct.
Is there any evidence in the record of any other drug distribution operations, pipelines of distribution quantities of cocaine from Chicago to Quincy with the Black Peastone Nation?
No, Your Honor.
Probably only one, and that would be these guys, right? And there's nothing in the record that would suggest that there was rival cocaine distribution rings from Chicago that set up shop in Quincy.
No, but there's also no evidence that this was the only distribution pipeline.
Nothing either way.
Nothing either way. If the court doesn't have any questions, I'll cede the rest of my time.
Thank you, Cosmo. Mr. Bohm.
Good morning, Your Honors. Jason Baum on behalf of the United States. In 2006, Sylvester Perham came to Quincy essentially as a stock boy for the Black Peastones to stock the shelves with crack cocaine. He continued in this role until 2008, until when he went to prison. When he got out in May of 2010, he was essentially promoted to the store manager of Quincy, directing others on how to stock the shelves with the crack cocaine. We submit that Judge Myerscough correctly held him attributable for the acts he undertook in 2006 through 2008 and enhanced his role as the leader organizer in 2010 and 2011. And Judge Rovner, to your question on Howard Perham, the evidence below was that he didn't come to town until around 2010 when his brother Sylvester was released from state custody, so he was not involved in 2008. That's why that amount was not attributable to him. But we agree that Sylvester would be held at a minimum accountable for the same amount of drugs that Howard was accounted for from 2010 through 2011.
And that amount is 840?
That's what Judge Myerscough found, yes, Your Honor.
You argued that with relation to the relevant conduct determination, the gap in time between the 2008 and the 2010 offense is irrelevant because it was non-volitional due to his imprisonment. But if the 2008 drug transactions ended when he was imprisoned, doesn't that establish that it was not similar to the 2010-2011 conspiracy? Because that offense was conducted almost entirely from prison. And if he couldn't continue his 2008 trade from prison, why should we find it was similar to the subsequent offense conducted from prison?
I don't think there's any evidence that the drug dealing in Quincy stopped in 2008 when he went to prison. In fact, I believe Now, the PSR references other individuals, Robert Miller and others, who were in Quincy at the time, and I don't think it stopped when he went to prison. It's just that once he got out in 2010, he took a new role in the same gang drug distribution that was ongoing from the time he was there in 2006 through 2008. I hope that answers your question.
Well, not really. Because among the similarities, among the allegations, I'm sorry, of similarity that you presented in the brief, are that multiple ounces were transported each time that the drugs were restocked once they were sold. But that's always true in the drug trade. Wouldn't it be extremely rare, if not unheard of, to have drug trafficking in only a single ounce at a time, or where the drug deliveries were not related at all to drug sales? And I'm sorry. The amounts of drugs that were involved in the 2008 transactions were significantly greater than the amounts in the offense of conviction.
Yes, I think, and that's correct. I think one way to explain that is the difference in his role in 2006 to 2008 was he was the transporter bringing it down for the gang members ahead above him. When they're gone in 2010, when he comes out, now he's directing others. So yes, he's not personally transporting as much. That doesn't mean he's not responsible for as many ounces being transported from Chicago to Quincy.
But in order to be considered relevant conduct, the 2008 conduct has to have been part of the same course of conduct, scheme, or common scheme or plan as the offense of conviction. It has to be part of a single episode, a spree, or an ongoing series of offenses. And what we have to consider is, is there significant similarity, regularity, temporal proximity between the uncharged acts and the offense of conviction? And I'm not sure we have it here.
I believe we do, Your Honor. If I may, the similarities are in the 2006 to 2008 acts, the 2010 through 2011 acts, interrupted only with Sylvester's participation, not others' participation, is his incarceration involved the same drugs, crack cocaine, coming from the same place, Chicago, to the same place, Quincy, for the same purpose, obviously, to be sold, using the same associations, the Black Peace Stones, to transport it and to facilitate that entire scheme.
So every time someone goes to jail and the gang continues, that someone is responsible and that someone...
No, I'm not suggesting he's responsible for what happened in the interim between when he was incarcerated. I'm saying he's responsible for his acts participating in that common scheme in 2006 through 2008, and he's responsible for his acts in 2010 through 2011. He didn't cease other than being incarcerated from 2008 through 2010.
Would you concede that other than involving multiple ounces, the drug amounts were not at all similar?
I would. I believe that there was similar amounts of crack cocaine flowing into Quincy in 2006 through 2008 and in 2010 through 2011. I would concede that Sylvester Perham's physical transporting it of him, by himself, He did not nearly deal in as much crack cocaine personally bringing it himself in the later years as he did in the prior years. But I don't think the organization reduced or decreased the amount of crack cocaine flowing into Quincy.
And in any event, it's all distribution quantity. This is not anybody who's carrying to Quincy so they've got enough to use while they're there and then they can leave.
That's absolutely true. There's no user amounts being transported by anyone at any time. If there are no further questions, I would cede the balance of my time.
Thank you. Thank you.
I would just like to take a minute to respond to a couple of the assertions made by the government. First, the government acknowledges that Sylvester Perham played a markedly different role in the 2008 transactions as the 2010-2011 transactions. This court in United States versus Ortiz found the fact that the defendant played a different role and used different drug weights to be significant in determining that there was not enough to show...
Different organization?
I'm sorry?
Was it involving a different organization?
I don't believe so. The other thing that I would like to point out is that the government makes a lot of hay over the fact that Mr. Perham's involvement in the drug distribution network was interrupted by his incarceration. But as Judge Rovner points out, the 2010-2011 involvement also occurred during a period of incarceration. And additionally, the Ruiz case, which the government uses in its brief to assert that an involuntary secession of activity is not necessarily enough to find that relevant conduct didn't occur or that the same transaction wasn't occurring, also says it might not be fatal. But this does not absolve the district court of the responsibility to otherwise explain why this gap in time is not significant. The district court clearly did not do so here. So all that we have evidence of is that Mr. Perham was involved in drug transactions in 2008, and then that he was involved in drug transactions involving different people in 2010 to 2011. Accordingly, I would ask this court to reverse and remand for resentencing. Thank you.
Ms. Kramer, you were appointed to represent your...
Yes. All right.
Thank you very much for your fine service to your client and taking the appointment.
Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel. Case